So this is Ryan Nilsson sitting with Sam Trickey on August 17th. It's about noon, and we're at Sam Trickey's house in Gainesville, Florida. So we'll just get started. So Sam, can you tell me how you first got involved with the National Farm Worker Ministry?
So Ryan, I wrote you a long email with a lot of details, and if I were to read it back, it would take a lot of your storage on your recorder. So let me see if I can do it more briefly.
And we can attach that.
Yeah, right. Yeah. But the basic story is that my first wife is Mexican American, born in South Texas, of parents who came across the border to escape the Mexican Revolution. Her name is Lydia, or in Spanish, Lydia Hernandez. Her father, Jose Angel Hernandez, converted to Protestantism sometime after he came to the United States and went to a special training program at Austin Presbyterian Theological Seminary in Austin to become a pastor. So he was a pastor of Spanish language, overwhelmingly or almost essentially 100% Mexican and Mexican-American Presbyterian churches in South and Central Texas. New Braunfels, Victoria, Falfurrias, Weslaco, basically anywhere from Austin south over his life. Those congregations had significant subsets, significant groups that followed the old classical migrant stream, and in particular the migrant stream from Texas typically went to the Midwest, Illinois, Wisconsin, Michigan, cherries in Wisconsin, I don't remember what in Michigan, field crops, tomatoes and vegetables and that sort of thing in northern Illinois out west of Chicago near Rochelle. So those activities were organized through the old National Council of Churches migrant ministry and related state and local migrant ministries. Now, I'm doing this from memory. I don't have records, and I don't have my ex-wife and I are not on good terms, and so I don't have access to her as a resource either. I believe, if memory is right, it was the summer of 1965. My father-in-law, Grandpa Joe, we called him, Reverend Hernandez, was working for a local or state migrant ministry in Wisconsin. Remember at that time that the whole civil rights fervor was sweeping the country in minority groups in general, and Cesar Chavez and the UFW had become an incredibly emotional, visceral, powerful force within the Mexican-American community, very analogous with, but not quite as much noticed as Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. had become with African-Americans. Okay, so Reverend Hernandez some workers he was working with heard about the UFW and decided to do an action. And my memory is it was a parade. I don't think it was a strike. I may have said in my notes to you that it was a strike, but now that I've thought about it, I think it was a parade. Calling attention to their desire for better working conditions, better wages, and so forth. And he, Reverend Hernandez, joined that effort thinking that because it was clearly for the benefit of the workers, the local migrant ministry board would support him. And to his surprise, although not to the surprise of those of us who've been around for a while now, the board was controlled by influential local business people, including growers, and they fired him. This simply hardened his resolve, or in old vocabulary from the 60s, it radicalized him. So the United Farm Workers and farm worker organizing more generally became a topic in our family. I was pretty deeply incorporated into that family. It's a big family. It's a typical Mexican family. You always get together at Christmas. There was no question we went to their family, we would sometimes go to my family. But you had to end up in Austin with their family and so on. So, okay. That's the beginning. Now, I was in graduate school at the time, so my focus was on getting a degree in theoretical physics, not on social justice work. I also don't come out of a union background. I come out of a very, very cautious sort of old-fashioned Republican conservative background, a father who was a faculty member at what's now the University of North Texas, and mother who was a public school teacher, both in an era when academic freedom certainly wasn't a big deal. So they were extremely cautious, but they're nothing like modern Republicans. They're much more like what you would think of the Robert Taft kind of Republicans in 1948 in Ohio. And so my parents were from Michigan, Indiana, Illinois. So that's my natural instinct was not to pay a whole lot of attention other than to listen and learn, but slowly be moved by the correspondence between what was going on with these workers. And I had married into this family, had learned to speak Spanish, had begun really to understand the pervasive effects of racism and social prejudice and so forth. Again, I'm being a typical physicist and digressing from myself here, but remember, in Texas at that time, racial segregation involved both Mexicans and blacks. When Lydia, my ex-wife, and I got married, it was illegal for us to do so because anti-miscegenation laws were still in the books. We had to go through a bit of subterfuge to get a marriage license. That's a whole other story. So I had learned, because of my emotional and personal commitment to and in this family, I had really learned to face up a lot of the realities of being poor and being racially prejudiced against that had been abstract for me learning in the church as in high school particularly. Okay. So in 1966, the Presbyterian Student Association, and again, I don't have any records of this, so I think it's spring because I think the Mellon strike was in spring. It may be as late as 1967. Anyway, there was a watermelon strike in South Texas by UFW. It was extremely futile. You can plow watermelons under in an afternoon, in a manner of speaking. And it was brutally broken up by the Texas Rangers. Now, I showed you this picture of A.Y. Alley, then the poster, and we can take a picture of it later. He was captain of the Rangers, and it was a famous and brutal and notorious strike. A bunch of people in the Presbyterian Student Association basically said to me, Sam, you're married into a Mexican family and they know something about this farm worker organizing business. Find out what's going on in South Texas and do a program for us. Now, the truth is, I don't have any notes from that. I don't really remember what I talked about. I just remember that I did it. Again, my focus was on getting my degree and getting done. But that meant that I had to begin to learn the issue, and I actually still have documents, issues of El Malcriado that were published in the Valley and so forth from that time. But anyway, we moved here in September of Florida, in September of 1968. Because it was the only job I could get, and that was after spending a few weeks with Ohio Migrant Ministry and Dark County Migrant Ministry near, is it Greenville, Ohio? It's not too far from Dayton. We can look on a map. I think it's Greenville. Okay, that's another tangle. Lydia's brother, David, had become director of this regional or county migrant ministry in Ohio. And when I got my PhD, there were no jobs. I sent out, I've forgotten, 147 or something resumes. Got one interview and no offer. So we stored all our furniture with her parents in Austin. They had retired by that time. And just took our car and some clothes and some cameras and went to Ohio and worked for David. And Lydia is a registered nurse, so she was working in the clinics. I drove a school bus for migrant children, so I was up at, 4:30 in the morning, and driving the bus, probably illegally since I didn't have a commercial permit, but nobody noticed. Translated in legal aid clinics, I think it was two nights a week, and spent most of my daytimes going around looking at farms and at labor camps for violations that were potentially reasons for action by the Ohio Labor Department. I didn't put in the notes, by the way, that that's how I met Valdemar Velasquez. I was 20, I must have been 27 at the time. And I think he was 24 or 5. He's a year or two younger than I am, I think. He may be a year. No, he's a year or two younger than I am. And I've said several times in public, much to Muldermiller's amusement, that my take on it at the time was that this guy didn't have a chance. That, you know, it was Farmer Labor Organizing Committee was Baltimore, and it felt like, you know, three of his closest and dearest friends and a couple of members of his family, and that was about it. But, I mean, obviously, the point is that that whole farm worker movement, once UFW got going, and remember, UFW itself has a very complicated set of origins with the Filipino workers, the Mexican workers, and so forth. Once that got going, it caught. It was kind of like almost like a disease, except a very beneficial one. It caught in other places spontaneously. I mean, roll forward, what was it, 1996 in Quincy out here in West Florida, the mushroom strikers went on strike. And Virginia Nesmith says I tell this story a little bit overblown. My memory is that it's pretty close to right. They basically went on strike and called up UFW in La Paz and said, by the way, you have a strike in Quincy, Florida. And La Paz said, where is that? I know Rebecca Harrington got there, and I was the first member of Farm Worker Ministry to go over there. Anyway, I digress. That's many years later. But the point is, this movement catches on because people are motivated to do it. And so there was Baltimore struggling away in his middle 20s with what I thought was a hopeless task. So anyway, we moved to Florida. Got involved very heavily with a brand new local Presbyterian congregation, Westminster Presbyterian, of which I am still a member. We're very strong advocates for a strong social justice and compassionate ministry component of a new church. I'm fond of saying that our presbytery sent Westminster out to be an experimental church without defining the experiment. It was a rocky time. There was a lot of controversy. I will put it this way. I'm a very, very articulate debater, and my tongue was too sharp with some of my Christian sisters and brothers, and I regret that. The church staggered along some, but it remains today very much classical, almost conservative in theology, but very strong in its social outreach. So, Lydia...
Can you comment further on what the... dispute was
about. Well, let me go back to that. Go back. What was the dispute about? It's more or less a conventional church versus non-conventional, and the symbolic issue was to whether or not build buildings, and if you build a building, what kind of building. And this placed a social justice, and we'll go back to Lydia's and my history in a minute. This placed a social justice in the following sense. If you build a conventional sanctuary with pews and so forth, you've A, got a big mortgage, and B, you've got a building you cannot use except for liturgical purposes. And what we ended up doing was building the building, which is now our community building, which had no fixed seating, had an open floor, could be used as a kitchen, could be used as a meeting room, and was comparatively modest in terms of its impact on our income. Now, it was still a stretch, but so anyway. So Lydia got in touch, and I again do not remember how. I would guess through her brother David, maybe through her father, with a man named August Vandenbosch, who was director of Florida Christian Migrant Ministry. And he immediately got us involved in working with FCMM, which was an autonomous state migrant ministry. But Augie knew Chris Hartmeyer. He knew what was going on in California. Remember, this was all connected through the Old National Council of Churches migrant ministry. I believe, but you would have to check with somebody that knows more authoritatively than I, because Augie died a few years ago. I believe that Augie was a field worker for the National Council of Churches. Pretty sure that's, at least initially, I'm quite sure that's how he was put here. Bob Sandman would know. Chris Hartmeyer would know, for sure. So, at that point, it's 1968, early 1969. Now you're in the middle of the Great Boycott and all the UFW stuff. So we became the people that brought UFW, pardon me, issues and campaigns and stuff to Gainesville. And Gainesville was a very small town at that point. I don't remember the population, probably 45, 50,000 at the most. University enrollment of, let us guess, 16,000 or something, as opposed to roughly 50,000 or 48,000 now. So, very rural place, and a university that was not happy about its faculty and being engaged in social justice publicly. So, I sent you an article about that. Anyway, we can talk about that. So, anyway, by now, I should have looked this up. I believe that UFW started its citrus organizing in 1969, but it may be 1970, it may not 1968. I'm vague on that point, but we can find out. There's boxes and boxes and boxes of paper in here in this closet. That meant that they opened, and they put a bunch of pressure on Coca-Cola, who owned Minute Maid, because it was a clearly boycottable set of products. Minute Maid, very well known on the East Coast, particularly, and Coca-Cola, of course, known internationally. And that led to a contract. I don't remember what year, but somewhere in the early 70s, by 1971, I think it is, they had field offices in Avon Park and Fort Pierce and, gosh, again, I don't remember. I will have to find out. It's all known. So Lydia and I were very involved with that, as was the rest of Florida Christian Migrant Ministry, and there were a lot of people. And there came out of that the roots of the now modern-day Presbyterian Church Hunger Program came out of a church somewhere over in the Tampa Bay area, and I can't remember the name of the church now. Again, I didn't prepare well for this, but we can find it. That's how it happened. Now, the why did it happen is another story, but...
Yeah. Well, I was... do you want to venture some...
No, I mean, you're the question. You're the question. The man with the question.
Yeah, well, I think we'll get to kind of why it happened, but I'm interested in this particular church that you've talked about in the context over... To what degree was that Westminster Presbyterian involved and supportive of the boycott over in your in general?
Well, okay, Westminster has been not your classic progressive church, so it's very cautious about passing resolutions and that sort of thing, but it has been supportive. what year did Chavez visit first? I want to say 1974, maybe 1973, at any rate. He visited in Gainesville. He stayed in our house. After the speech at the university, so the speech was organized through a student organization that brings in famous people to give public speeches, and it had the character of a rally in what's called the Plaza of the Americas, big green space in front of the library. There was a discussion meeting with him in person of supporters, 25, 30 people. And that was held in the home of Glenn Dixon, who was the pastor of the church. And Glenn basically organized having his house open and having a discussion there. The leadership of the church was very supportive in terms of helping support resolutions in the presbytery, in the Synod, the tangled story again. We were a Southern Presbyterian Church, PCUS. We converted ourselves into a union congregation, so we were in both synods and both presbyteries, the old PCUSA without the parentheses, so-called Northern Church and the so-called Southern Church. So that meant that we had a chance, among other things, to both introduce I'm missing the word. It's not resolutions. What are they called? Overtures. to both presbyteries, but we also had to defend attacks on pastors in congregations that were socially active from people that were very socially conservative. Keep in mind that the Southern Church, in particular at that time, was deeply troubled by the tensions over desegregation and the associated social implications. There were several congregations that departed the denomination. There were ancillary disputes and very, very intense ones over ordination of women. I recall having to go to Orlando to a Senate of Florida meeting where a church in South Florida was being disciplined for its refusal to ordain a woman as a ruling elder, I believe. Yeah, I think it was a ruling elder ordination. So the congregation was very supportive of that. They were supportive individually of the boycotts at that time, Great Boycott, later Lettuce Boycott, supportive of involvements by me and by Lydia. Lydia went several times to California to participate in various actions where, by this time, NFWM was formed in 1971 out of the old migrant ministry. So, and I haven't narrated anything about the struggles that it took to get Florida Christian Migrant Ministry to change its mind and become part of NFWM. And there were a lot of reasons for that, I think mostly good. But anyway, so early NFWM and FCMM cooperated. Later, FCMM dissolved itself into NFWM. A lot of pressure on FCMM at that time, budget pressure, influential people pulling their money out. So, you know, I suspect if you had the books of the old FCMM, you'd find out that the budget peaked in probably 1970 and started downward after. Controversy does not necessarily engender contributions. So you were asking about supportive things. I know I went... Well, in the Teamsters strike in 1975, I went for a week to help be a translator in that sort of thing in Coachella. And as I recall, the General Assembly paid some of my expenses, but the congregation took up an ad hoc collection to pay for some of it. I mean, I was, you know. So
you've generally been supportive.
Generally been supportive, but not, I would say, demonstrative it's not the kind of, but I mean, we had 2 years ago, we had Farm Worker Awareness Week, and our interim pastor at that time surprised me actually on Sunday morning. I walked in for worship and he says to me, I'm preaching on such and such passage. I can tell you what it was if I thought about it. And about a third of the way into the sermon, I'm going to ask you to come and respond to the meaning of that passage in terms of the farm worker ministry. So I have about 20 minutes of the liturgy to take. Well, I mean, the church has taught me well and farm worker ministry has taught me well, and I hope not arrogant. I'm a reasonably gifted public speaker. If I know what I'm talking about, I can stand up and talk about it pretty persuasively. But still, 20 minutes warning and supposedly singing the hymns and saying my prayers and so forth. The point was that no one in the congregation was shocked about that, or no one, essentially. I was a little unusual, but it was not totally off the wall. The church gives, I think, $1,000 a year to NFWM in its budget and has so for 20 years. You know, so it's supportive, but it's not the sort of church where you get, after coffee hour, we're all headed to Publix to do the demonstration. It's a little tamer than that.
and that's become a more Has that changed? Is it distinct now from what it was when you first started?
No, I'd say that generally we have tried in Westminster to say to people that we are a body of Christian people and that we take seriously the Reformed tradition that the laity must give assent to one and only one question, namely the acceptance of Jesus Christ as personal Lord and Savior. So doctrinal conformity is not a legitimate question. And implicit doctrinal conformity, that is to say, agreeing with and putting your signature on a petition or going to a demonstration, is not an appropriate. Now, it's very clear that people who are very strongly socially conservative, who view Christianity as essentially liturgical and personal, a combination of liturgy and personal morality, are not going to be comfortable in that congregation most of the time, although, to be truthful there and to be actually in some sense a blessing, there are some people who fit that description who are there. And my reading on that is that their view of people like me is sort of like my view of people like them. Namely, I don't understand their vocation, but it is not my privilege to stand in judgment. That is, these are Christian sisters and brothers. They share the same baptism, the same communion, the same gospels, the same covenants, full stop. That does not mean I understand what they're up to, but that's a separate question. Okay. And mostly in Westminster, we have these discussions pretty intensely, but pretty in a kind of intense gentleness. Nobody's running somebody else out on the basis of heresy trials. Okay. Now, it was much more taught in the early days of the congregation in that regard. Because in some sense, one can hardly talk about tradition in a church that's only 40 years old, but 43 years old. But there were no practices. There was no kind of unstated but clear social compact amongst us. There is now. If you come to Westminster now and you've talked to people in Gainesville, you know that it is a kind of odd combination of informal but more or less conventional worship, a lot of Sunday school and Bible school and that sort of thing, and a lot of social outreach.
Yeah.
It's not your usual. And it causes, by the way, a problem. We're way off target from NFW. It causes a problem, and that is it causes an evangelical problem because we don't fit well in anybody's categories.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't grow a lot.
Sometimes that's good though, not fitting.
Okay. Well, but it has its problems.
Yeah. Okay. So I think some of that conversation transitioned nicely. I'm interested in your personal why for you it's okay to you that not everyone in the community has these social convictions or practices, that they're not all involved with the farm worker movement, but for you particularly, how have your beliefs and values led you to your involvement with the National Farm Worker Ministry?
Well, I can't resist a witticism. I mean, with people who do not yet understand the social justice issues of Christianity, my view is that of a teacher. There's always time to learn. Now, that sounds condescending, but why does it? Why am I there, and why am I still there? 1966, if you want to use that as the date, which is the one I do, because it was the first time I ever opened my mouth in public on advocacy of farm workers. So that's 45 years out of 70. This isn't going to make good public propaganda. I would rather not. It would be more convenient not. It would be more convenient not to be Christian. I can't not. I really am influenced by Calvin's thinking. I've read some Calvin. I've read some of the theology. I've had a little bit of formal theological training. I was reared in the old Northern Presbyterian Church, albeit in North Texas. You know, Yankees had moved south and had set up congregations. But this particular congregation actually had been a Cumberland church and had become a PCUSA somewhere in the 19-teens. And the church school literature of that era, okay, so I'm talking about, I was born in 1940, so the church school literature of when I was 8, 10, 12, 14, 15, and so forth, was literature that was very, I still have some of the books, was, and I've gone back and looked at them, was very much a combination of sort of mainstream classical Reformation theology and a kind of liberal social progress set of ideas, very characteristic of mainstream Protestantism, 1930s, 1940s, early 1950s. As a friend of mine once said, Sam, you know what's wrong with us? This, we were on our way to Lakeland to try to have an interview with the president of Publix. This was, God, what was this about? I think this was about lettuce, but it as one says in Texas vernacular, don't matter. He says to me, do you know what's the matter with us? And I said, no. A guy named Ken. No, Ken, what's the matter? He said, we took Sunday school too seriously. But he's right, in a certain kind of way. I have a very difficult time discerning my calling looking forward. I did not intend to be a theoretical physicist. I got interested in theoretical physics when I was in graduate school. I went to graduate school to get a master's degree, ended up getting a PhD because a department chair got me a PhD scholarship without my knowing about it. It announced to me in the hallway one day that I was a PhD student. Oh, really? So I have a difficult time discerning calling looking forward. I have a tendency to do what I think, and I don't think there's anything very profound about this, but I think what sounds right in terms of what I've learned and been taught in the church, and trust by now, having lived a fairly long life, that looking back, it will make some sense. Some things don't. My grandson's death 2 weeks ago makes no sense at all. Okay? None. But coming to Florida, looking back, makes a lot of sense for two reasons. Professionally, I ended up in one of the best groups in the world in an area where it turns out I actually have some pretty serious talents. Okay? I had to change specialties to fit into that group, but given the job market, there was no choice. At the time, it seemed like an absurd burden. Looking back, it's a blessing. Okay? Coming to Florida made sense because in terms of church witness and in terms of farm worker witness, a Spanish-speaking gringo who can speak in public and argue with the growers on the basis of facts. Let me come back to that in a minute because that's an issue of style, but it's a very deliberately chosen one. Becomes an asset to farm workers and to social justice more generally. Now, again, I don't want to sound pompous. I don't think, you know, I'm certainly not Chris Hartmeyer. I'm not Cesar Chavez, okay? I'm sort of second rank importance, and that's okay because I decided that my calling was to be a physicist and an academic and a Christian who could say with authenticity, I don't work for an organization that is committed to farm workers. This is a decision I made on the basis of my prayers and my thoughts, and I don't get any money out of it. It's not my career. Not to demean people for whom it was. I have huge admiration for Chris Hartmeyer. Okay, huge, amazing guy. Enormous sense of loss with Fred Eister, who was one of my best friends and who died way prematurely. He was a session director. Missed the chance to see Richard Cook. I mean, these guys. And you know, Virginia's service, holy mackerel. And she struggled with the anxieties of budget and the vicissitudes of the different priorities of different unions and so forth. I mean, but my calling was different. And looking back, it makes sense. I made a remark about style. Style by style here, I don't mean superficial. I mean a choice of the way of going about things. What I always did and still do is I come at these controversies as a man who knows numbers, who is a scientist, and who knows facts when he sees them. So, and then because I also have the right accent, well, nearly the right accent. My accent, native accent, is Northern Texan, but I've learned to speak sort of generic Southern. So the people can't knock me for being an outsider. I'm not, okay? My degrees are, my high school is in Texas. My university degrees are in Texas. I've lived almost all my adult life in the South. I eat barbecue as happily as anybody else. I know what black-eyed peas are on New Year's Day. You know, the whole bit. You cannot knock me as an outsider. And I play that game, okay? I will deliberately go to rallies or speeches. I do wear cowboy boots. I wear them at times just because I want to feel ethnic. But when I go and I give talks, I will deliberately do it. It's a symbol. It basically takes away this outside agitator business, okay? And then I go after people on the facts. You know, where are your data about the $150 a day tomato pickers? Show me your numbers. Prove to me that those numbers, if you have them, don't represent under one Social Security number the contributions of, let's say, a family of seven. Okay? Prove to me that you are enforcing these pesticide regulations that you talk about so much. Prove to me that you have trained these people. Prove to me that they can read the labels. All right? I mean, these are all rhetorical devices, but they are aimed at issues that are pertinent to farm workers. And what I have learned, what I learned very early on, was that that rhetorical style or that approach was of value to the farm workers, and it's one that I'm comfortable with. I'm not terribly comfortable with some of the other styles, but that's not the point. Other people are gifted at that. But I can and have made significant progress in debates on presbytery floors and in open forums and my mother would cringe, fora, sorry, the Latin plural. My mother was an English and Latin teacher. The other point is to go after the theology. What do you mean when you talk about the spirituality of the church? I grew up in Southern environment. I have heard all these arguments about the church as a liturgical collection of moral people. Read to me the last part of Matthew 25, please. Okay? Go through the New Testament and read how many places Jesus addresses the poor. Read to me the places where the remarks are, woe to you, and the woe is because people are practicing their faith hypocritically. They are exploiting people. Okay? That combination, a physicist who insists on arguing about the numbers and the data and ties it to theological arguments, is one that these people are not accustomed to running into. And that's sort of been my niche. It has its limits, okay? But that's been my niche.
When you say these people, unsupportive, unsympathetic people within the church.
Well, representatives of growers at meeting. You know, the typical issue. You have a meeting at something. It's not as common nowadays, but it used to be. And we have to have both sides. Okay. Or when you get into as someone once called it, a squirting match with a skunk in the press, and so you have to write letters to the editor, or you have to be interviewed by the local TV station, or what have you. I was I was much more visible in the 70s than I am now, much more. I mean, I was very careful never to be interviewed on campus, never to let a reporter say that, or imply that my role as a faculty member of the university gave some authority to what I was talking about, farm workers. Authority came from my direct knowledge. Again, what farm worker ministry, with the support of the Presbyterian Church, did was frequently allow me to go, allow Lydia and me to go, allow her to go, and see things. Okay, and again, the authenticity issue is I speak Spanish. So I would run into these grower representatives that would say, you know, well, we know that the workers in, I don't know, Delano, let's go back to 1971, are dissatisfied with UFW. And I said, really? Do you speak Spanish? Well, no. Well, who translated for you? Well, you know, well, I was there 6 weeks ago. I mean, making this up. But, you know, it was that kind of thing, okay? So, why do you keep doing it? I'm back to that question. Because that's my calling.
I hadn't asked that one explicitly yet, but it's
no, but that's my calling. I thought you did ask it. I cannot stand up in church on Sunday morning and say one of the classic creeds of the Presbyterian Church Book of Confessions is, you know, everything from the Barman Declaration back to the Apostles' Creed. I cannot do that. I cannot lead worship. I cannot do any of that and then turn around and ignore Matthew 25. Okay, it just can't be done. I mean, there is a wholeness here, and I'm not, again, don't misunderstand me. Sam Tricky has all manner of flaws and sins, some of which I will talk about and some of which I will only confess in private. That's not my point. The point is that I have to, as a matter of calling, put up that struggle toward and for consistency. Right? And it would simply, it would be a blatant hypocrisy to do otherwise. That's the answer to that question.
Yeah, okay. Great. You, when you were talking about discerning your calling, you said you can look back and understand more kind of where you've come and how some of that made sense. Are there a couple anecdotes that you could share that were things that clicked, like specific stories, lessons in your
God,
position?
Yeah, I mean, they're all manner of stories. Gee, again, I need the dates. But sometime in the early 1970s, the Florida Farm Bureau Federation had an editor, a guy named Al Alsobrook, who started in on UFW organizing in Florida. And he said some things to some local radio stations, including one that was an AM country station that I occasionally listened to, just reminded me of home. And they were about the situation in California. I'm being vague because I haven't refreshed my memory on this in a long time. But, and I heard, let's see, how did this happen? I heard on the car radio a quote from him that I was pretty sure was not true, but I wasn't sure I'd heard it rightly. And if I remember correctly, I went down to the studio. It was a little studio on Kincaid Road on the east side of Gainesville. I may have called the guy. I don't remember. Anyway, I remember that they played it back for me. And it was clearly untrue. So I said to the radio station that it was untrue. And somehow it got into the newspaper, the Gainesville Sun. I don't remember how. At any rate, Alsobrook wrote a letter to the paper. And I wrote back and said, no, Mr. Alsobrook doesn't have it right. I was there, you know, and it just had to do with what was going on in California. The idea was to discredit UFW in Florida by what was going on in California. That was the basic issue. Let the record be clear. I am not fond of Al Alsobrook. Okay? He was later in the administration of the university. I thought it was a mistake. I dislike the man. Okay. And I would say that to his face, although I generally, when I've been around him, have been formally polite. That's Southern. So he quit doing things in the press, open press, and he published an article in the Florida Farm Bureau magazine. The article is entitled Dear Dr. Tricky, and it was on the cover page of the magazine. Now, mind you, I was not tenured at that point, which means this must have been 1970. Two, because I was tenured in 73. So here I have a new child and another one on the way, or maybe Philip had been born by that time. No, Philip was born in January 72, so I had an infant as well. Untenured, not terribly popular in the physics department because of my social justice involvement. Our department chair did not like the idea. The prior department chair didn't like it. That's yet another story. So my next door neighbor over on 11th Road, I lived about six blocks from here, was a guy who actually worked at the Farm Bureau part-time. And he came over one evening and said, I need to tell you something in utmost secrecy. And this is 30-some years later, so I don't think I've ever even told this piece of it. I may have hinted at it. I think what I've said in public is I got word privately. It was my neighbor. Farm Bureau is about to print a really nasty article about you. You better be prepared. Well, you know. You know, how did that work? I talked to Tom Scott, who was department chair, and then Herman Spivey, who was acting dean. And I remember Dean Spivey had very nice Tidewater, Virginia accent and said, well, Sam, I cannot temper your understandable anxiety. He goes on, and I can't say that, not an accent I can do, but anyway. But he said, as long as I am dean and you have behaved according to academic freedom standards as meticulously as you have, no harm will come to you. And Tom Scott had told me. Now, Tom Scott was not a man who particularly liked me. But boy, you talk about integrity. Tom told me to call the dean, and the dean told me, you're okay. That's just remarkable. The other one that I think is in the 75th, I mean, I can tell you a lot of them. The 75th anniversary book is commemorating the anniversary, not of NFWM, but of the founding of the Old Migrant Ministry. We had a presbytery or synod meeting down at Eckerd College, and I'm also fairly clever at parliamentary procedure. I have Presbyterian ancestors way back. And so I had put my name on the list or had been recognized by the chair to speak and waived my speech but reserved the right to speak later. And it was a very intense debate about a farm worker issue related to what became the hunger program. And this is this circular building. I think it's still at Eckerd College. Glenn Dixon, my pastor, was sitting next to me. And there was all this business. Bill Litch was one of the old stalwarts of the Old Migrant Ministry. Wonderful man. Bill had spoken, and there are people on the grower side had spoken about the classic $100 a day. It's $150 now, but it's all mythological. Worker. And so then I claimed my time to speak. And I went down to this rostrum. And typically when I speak, I don't write things out. I write a little 4x4 piece of notepaper just with what nowadays would be called bullet points. Again, this sounds arrogant, but I'm trying to be honest. And it's the same story that's in that book. Usually when I speak, I'm pretty good at it, okay? This was different. This was eerie. I get emotional about it even now. It is one of my few direct experiences with the immediate working of the Holy Spirit, and I don't use those words lightly. Ryan, every single word was right. Not just good, right. The room went silent. Now, as I say, I'm a good public speaker. I'm not that good, okay? I went back to my chair, and I mean, I had some sense that something strange was going on. I went back to my chair, and Glenn Dixon said to me, do you know what you just did? And I said, well, I thought it was pretty effective, or some words like that. He said, you just turned the debate completely around. I had to swallow hard to say that one, okay? You have to swallow hard to narrate that story. I mean, this is spooky, all right? I know the difference. I know when I'm good, and I know when something eerie is going on, okay? And that was something eerie. You don't forget such things. I actually have. I don't know whether the tape still is any good. I had a tape because they taped it in order to do the minutes. And a couple of times, it's so odd that I've only listened to it a couple of times. I've listened to it a couple of times. Yeah, it's my voice, my accent, but it's not me in some sense. I don't know how to, I don't even know how to narrate it. For a physicist, this sounds really weird, but that was a eerie, weird experience.
Can a physicist not have respect for the mystic?
It was a mysterious, eerie, spooky experience. Yeah. Something very special is going on there.
So what were the consequences?
The resolution failed or passed or whatever it was. I mean, Glenn was right. It did turn around. I don't know whether he was right about me, but the situation turned around. I mean, and there have been other less dramatic, I mean, but very remarkable things. Just, to stand with farm workers in places, when we were in California for the board meeting last year, and the workers were in a park, and again, I could talk with them some, and the many times, though, they have said to us, we did not know that we had friends in the city, you know. That always stuns me because they are so grateful to us, where it seems to me it probably ought to be the other way around. I mean, they're making me pay attention to the priorities of how I use my money and how I use my time and so on. And then, you know, there's just all sorts of, I mean, you get, I mean, I what kind of experience is it to have Cesar Chavez as your personal friend? I mean, man called me my first name, stayed in my house twice. I tell you one more strange thing. So Lydia and Matthew and Philip and I are living in California in 75, 76. I was on sabbatical in San Jose working for IBM. We go to La Paz. Right after the farm workers moved there. And we have a boycott lettuce sign on the bumper of our Volkswagen microbus. Or no, this may have been actually when we owned. I think this was earlier. Never mind. It was a boycott lettuce sticker on the back of our car. And Matthew, we reared our children in Spanish speakers. So Matthew only spoke Spanish at that time. And we're walking from Cesar's office around to the other building where the other offices were. And Matthew, who was at that point three and a half, something like that. This must have been 73 or 4. Grabs Cesar's hand, he starts to tell you. Señor Chavez. Si, Mateo. ¿Sabes qué dice? And he's pointing at the bumper sticker. Do you know what this says? No, Mateo, ¿qué dice? This is Chavez saying he doesn't know what, of course he knows. Oh, says Matthew, dice, no compre chuga. Well, no compre lechuga, but he's a child, so he can't say it. Oh, muy bien, Mateo. And so, I mean, this is a famous man, okay, with enormous stresses and problems, okay? And he takes a minute and a half to talk to a three-year-old who's explaining his own bumper sticker to him, okay? I, you know, stuff like that.
It's a great story.
Okay.
Well, another question, and you're talking, it seemed like you were articulating well how your cultural perspective, being Southern and being able to not be construed as being from the outside, has helped with speaking to and working within the Southern culture.
Yeah.
I wonder if you could comment more, having been to California and some of these other regions, on what is particular about the farm worker movement in the South generally, in Florida particularly, maybe?
Sure.
I guess specifically the work of the National Farm Worker.
Yeah, well, okay, for the unions and farm worker advocacy organizations, so UFW, Flock, which attempted to do some work here, but has pretty much withdrawn by in my judgment. I don't mean an unfair. They're not visibly present. They may still be supporting their workers that come here, but their focus is North Carolina and the Midwest. Farm Worker Association of Florida, CIW, which is not technically a union, but is certainly an effective farm worker advocacy organization. For all of them, the first real problem is symbolized by the existence of right-to-work laws, which is to say, if you have a state with a right-to-work law, you typically have a very hostile environment for any kind of worker organizing. There is a long Southern tradition. Burke Perry can talk to you about her father and how he was unwilling to deal with unions, even though it would have benefited him. There's a long Southern tradition of individualism and kind of personal tenacity in workers that have made them proud and hence unwilling to unionize. That's perhaps not as true in the blacks, the African Americans. Not particularly true in Mexican Americans or Mexicans. But there is not a climate, there is not a tradition of widespread unionization that there was in California. Secondly, there was not the tradition of liberal slash progressive slash socially oriented churches in the South that there was in California. Although, it must be said that there were more churches than people give credit for, but they also were very consumed by, and in some ways I think maybe worn out by, the struggles of desegregation. I mean, again, it's within my lifetime. Brown versus School Board, Board of Education rather, is 1954, which for me is either, I don't know, 7th or 8th grade, something like that. Little Rock Central High School is probably, 1956? I remember going through Texarkana when the National Guard was in Arkansas with a banner over the Texas-Arkansas border, "Welcome to the Occupied Territory of Arkansas." Churches took an enormous amount of stress dealing with that. And my sense looking back, I don't think I thought this at the time, but my sense looking back is that churches in the early 1970s in Florida were already stressed and tired and beleaguered by the whole business of dealing with desegregation. And add to that, farm worker organizing was for many of them simply more than they could cope with. I'm somewhat sympathetic to that. It's not what should have happened, but the pastoral part of me says it's not so surprising. Things were pretty stressful. And if you, again, come out of the Southern quietist, pietist kind of tradition, where the church is a source primarily of comfort, having a locus or a forum for controversy is itself a pretty mind-bending and hard thing to deal with. I don't agree with that, but again, these are Christian sisters and brothers, and they grew up in that kind of tradition. It is no surprise that they found this hard to deal with. So, those are the things which occur to me. The other thing that occurs to me is that in South Texas and in California, there was a long tradition of the presence of Mexicans. After all, big chunks of those are conquered territory. Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, okay, which anti-immigration people kindly and conveniently forget, but okay. Not okay, but anyway. Florida did not have that tradition. We have gone, Bert is fond of saying, and she's a little younger than I am, in our lifetime we have gone from a migrant scheme that is predominantly indigenous African-American to mixed African-American and Mexican-American to almost entirely Mexican and some extent Central American, particularly Immokalee is a lot of Central Americans, immigrants, the overwhelming majority of whom do not have documents. So that's a double shift. And if you're dealing with a culture that had been segregated to introduce new, allegedly inferior, that is to say allegedly because they're exploitable, therefore the syllogism is they must be inferior. Oh, I don't know why I laugh. It's not surprising, again, that you get a lot of tensions and that it's hard to do. I'm not saying that life wasn't tough. I mean, I've been in California a lot for a lot of actions and for a lot of campaigns. But I would say the difficulties here are different. Finally, there was no progressive tradition. There was some liberal democratic tradition in the Florida legislature in the 70s and into the early 80s. Governor Askew was a remarkable man, for example. But after that, it was just farther and farther and farther to the right. And by now, there is no viable progressive or socially concerned legislative tradition in the state at all. None. So it means that the state government is at best not a resource. Those are the ingredients that occur to me. There is the Civil War xenophobia too, the outside agitator business. It's one of the less charming aspects of the South, is this business that outsiders are suspect.
Well, I think thank you for that answer. That was good and comprehensive.
I talk a lot. Cynthia, when she first knew me, once said to me, "Sam, you don't answer questions, you tell stories." And my response without even thinking was, "Let me tell you a story." Come
on. I just meant because that's something I'm thinking about too. Yeah, it's good to hear kind of an overview of what your perspective is. If we could probably draw near to a close.
I can go in as long as you need.
The question, what would you like to say to people today who might be interested in getting involved with the National Farm Worker Ministry?
Well, I wrote something in the notes, probably more pertinent than anything I could invent on the top of my head. What did I say? Oh, yeah. Needs are large, but they're not intimidating. Well, what was the point of that remark? I run into people who say, "Oh, these social justice concerns are so immense. How can I do anything meaningful?" And the answer to that comes in a lot of different ways, but they're always the notion of don't underestimate yourself and don't overestimate the intimidation factor of the issue. I mean, remember when I got involved with that whole confrontation with the Farm Bureau Federation, it was me, my then spouse, and a Smith Corona typewriter on this very desk that you're looking at. I mean, that's not what you'd call it. The issue was tenacity and courage is too strong a word. I was scared, but I wasn't scared enough. I'm stubborn, so I wasn't going to give up. I was scared, but I was stubborn. So having looked at the budget of Farm Worker Ministry, yeah, I would love to see more contributors that give $5,000, $10,000, $15,000 a year. Bring it on. We need it. But we also need the people that give $25 a year and that will sign the petitions and that will once or twice a year go to the grocery store manager and say, you know, "My name is Jane or Susan or Joe or Bill or whatever, and I buy groceries here, and I want you to know about the workers in Immokalee or the workers in North Carolina or whatever." Because that, it's the water torture in a way. Okay, these companies do not give up mostly because of principle. They give up because they're weary of being beleaguered by people who will not quit. And the reason that people, the ability to avoid quitting is a lot higher if the burden is shared. So, you know, the need is great. It's not intimidating. And consumer action is really important. One of the facts that we learned early from Dolores and Chavez and Larry Etliong and all of the people that started UFW is that consumer action, sharing what I have, not just by giving money, but by giving my identity to the workers, is crucial. You know, when we met down in Central Florida board meeting a year ago, January, I guess it was. We went to a bunch of public stores, and you know, those managers can't do anything. They have no policy making authority. But Publix eventually is going to get tired of having their managers distracted by people bringing letters. They're going to get tired of having letters to the editor and blogs on the local TV station saying that, of course I like to shop at Publix. It's the best supermarket in Florida. In fact, it's almost a monopoly. But I don't like the way... You know, eventually, they're going to grow weary of it. Help us make them weary. Okay? What else are we going to say? I think the other thing, and this sounds selfish, but an activity like this is a diversion from consumption. It says that you give of yourself, you're not shopping, you're not buying, you're not hoping for gratification for some object. You're not actually hoping for gratification, but the assurance I can give you is that some kind of surprise, some worker will say something to you, or you will see a result that will surprise you, and it will be a gift in the sense that it was an unanticipated, unmerited gratification. So the irony is that you give, and somewhere, sometime, you know, I've had workers come up to me whom I don't remember people's names. A lot of times I don't remember faces. I've been to a lot of places because of the board meetings and the executive committee meetings and various speaking and so on. I've had workers come up to me and say, you know, you're the gringo who speaks Spanish that was here 4 years ago. I say, wow, it was that important? You know, that kind of thing. So for those who are Christian, I would say explicitly, Jesus is often quoted with regard to this business of the poor will always be with you. There is a reason. Look at what he does in his ministry. The poor are always with the people of his time and ours because it is always in somebody's selfish, short-term interest to exploit somebody. We as Christians are obliged to push back on that. The kingdom of heaven is not the kingdom of exploitation. So since it is always tempting to somebody to exploit somebody else, and our specialty is farm workers, and there's rampant exploitation, the thing to do is push back. And that's what I'd say. Join me in pushing back. Especially if you're younger, I'm getting old.
Is there anything else you want to add before we kind of close this?
Haven't I talked enough? It has been a saga that I did not expect. It takes me places that I sometimes did not like. I mean, there have been times I have been scared. But it's also taken me places that lead to wonderful stories and wonderful memories and a real sense of growing authenticity. I wouldn't say I've reached authenticity, but growing towards authenticity, maybe is a better word, in the Christian faith. Tell you one more story, just an anecdote, the Quincy Mellon strike. So I was in the university administration at that time, by the way, and I wrote an article for the local radical newspaper that became the cover article, and I think that helped me get into a real conflict with the university president, though he was never honest enough to admit it. He had all sorts of other ego issues. So I eventually, early that summer, I lost my job as chief information officer at the university, but that's another story. At any rate, I don't think it helped that there was an article, the local radical newspaper is called The Iguana, and there was a cover article by me about the Quincy Mellon strike. So we get news of the Mellon strike on, let's make this up, Tuesday or something like that, and I talked to Rebecca Flotus Harrington, whom I had known through Texas and who was a good friend of my ex-wife's. And I talked to, you know, Bert, and she couldn't go. And so finally I talked to Cynthia, to whom I've been married for now 28 years last Saturday. And say, okay, Rebecca, we can come up there first thing on Saturday morning. She says, meet me in Tallahassee because a delegation of the workers and I are going to be at the meeting with some AFL-CIO people, staff people in Tallahassee, the state capital. So we get on the road, you know, wee hours in the morning, and off we go. when was this? Probably February, March, something like that. And then we go out to Quincy. Well, the first place the workers, you know, because I'm the first person from NFWM to show up. I'm the nearest. So I bring them a message, and I've forgotten who was president then, but anyway, I got a letter faxed to me from the president of NFWM to the management at Quincy, and my job was to deliver it, supporting the workers. And then we went out to Quincy. Well, these are all Mexican workers, and so they've done a typical Mexican thing. They've built little booths along the side of the road. It looks for all the world like Zacatecas or Chihuahua or somewhere. Okay, they got little fires going, cooking. And we got some deputy sheriffs, and we got an injunction, of course, because the growers control the local district, state district court. And we have more money. Well, we've also got a guy there from the steel workers from Mobile, and he's another southerner, and he also speaks Spanish, and I don't know his name. It's too bad. I should have kept his name. Great guy. So we're talking with Rebecca, and we're talking with the workers. Rebecca has to leave, if I recall, but I don't remember that for sure. At any rate, or maybe she stayed in Tallahassee. I don't remember. Anyway, this guy from the steel workers and a couple of the worker leaders said to me, we've got a real problem because the sheriffs want us to take down all the booths and get off the street. So I said, okay. And none of the workers spoke English at a useful level. So we went to talk to the sheriffs. Well, this one older guy, sheriff's deputy, senior deputy or something, said, let me talk to you two in private. He said, I'll get a minute here. And so he had this other younger deputy who was really belligerent and obstreperous and bossy and loud and so forth. I don't know how this worked, but somehow he managed to get separated, sent the other guy off to patrol or something. I don't remember. He says, look, the older man, he says, you guys can do almost anything you want if you don't make me and the rest of the deputies look me up. But he says, I've got an injunction here. I have to at least give the appearance that I'm serious about enforcing it. And he says, can we work something out where we get the booths back off the road? We keep people out of the road. We don't distract traffic. He said, if we can, he says, I can keep the other guy under control. So, you know, he said, remember, none of us speak Spanish. He said, you guys have got to get this arranged. When, you know, how long are you here? Well, I'm going back to Gainesville tonight, or maybe it was the next day. Again, I don't remember. Doesn't matter. And the guy from the steelworkers, I think, was staying to Monday. At any rate, we went back, talked with the workers, explained to them, said, look, this is the reality of civil rights demonstrations in the South. You cannot embarrass the police, okay? It won't work. They're being watched by the locals. But if you'll kind of draw back and give them a little margin and be very respectful, they'll keep their part of the deal. And I was convinced, I've been around this kind of guy before, they'll keep their guys under control. Because what I was worried about is somebody be really belligerent and start shooting or something, okay? Not a realistic possibility, but it's always kind of in the back of your mind. So road back off the main state road, some other local yahoo could come by. What the workers didn't understand was they really needed the deputies out there to make sure that some guy with a real case of belligerence, and I could use some foul language, but let's not, you know, it's real hard, okay, come by and shoot them up, all right, in the night. Not good. Really not good. So we basically brokered a deal. And I think, I hope that senior police officer heard from me as an officer or as a representative. I came as a board member representative of an explicitly faith-based organization. I told him I was Christian. I was told him I was there for that reason. I hope what he heard was a witness that we disagree, but we respect you. We don't belittle you. Okay? And we know the strictures and constraints under which you're working. So took the letter up to the guardhouse, and this is a young woman who's a rent-a-cop, you know, security, and you know she could see she felt like her job was at risk if she even touched the envelope. It was kind of like as if I'd handed her an envelope of anthrax or something. She eventually took the letter. Eventually, they got a contract, and later the company closed the place. So, but one more story. Not the sort of thing you learn as a physicist.
Yeah. Well, thanks for your time this afternoon. It's been great.
I hope it's helpful.
All right.